Now, two decades after the Shaw trial, Jim Garrison finally tells his own story. He pieces together his thesis that President Kennedy was the victim of a conspiracy and cover-up involving elements of the CIA, the FBI, and state and local officials, all of them hell-bent on reversing the president's bold moves to lessen the tensions of the Cold War.
Every major move he made, and I'm saying move, not words, on this day he was sworn in, was written for him by members of staff. I mean, every major decision he made as president was toward ending the Cold War. So if you hear anybody describe him with a straight face as Cold War, you're talking to somebody who doesn't know what he's talking about. Kennedy did so much and made so much progress towards ending the Cold War that those Cold Warriors who were in our government had to kill him in order to keep the Cold War going.
What changes in policy can you point to that occurred after his assassination, where we might see a turnabout from earlier Kennedy policies to the new Johnson policies?
There were a series of them, but the most immediate one occurred within 72 hours after his assassination. His successor, Lyndon Johnson, who was a closet Cold Warrior all the time, and who in the Senate was known as the Senator from the Pentagon because of his war-oriented philosophy, within 72 hours of John Kennedy's death, right after the eulogy in the rotunda, Lyndon Johnson crossed over to the old office building and met with the ambassador to South Vietnam, Henry Lodge, and said, in effect, you can go back and tell the Vietnamese now that we're going to back them all the way. In other words, what he was doing within 72 hours, no position papers, no 6 weeks, 2 months studies by the military intelligence, within a few days, he was meeting with Lodge and telling him, we are changing the policy in the Far East 180 degrees. He reversed Kennedy's policy, and sure enough, in 18 months, he was pouring 500,000 American soldiers in there, an expeditionary force, with no reason. We were not even invited by South. We weren't wanted by South Vietnam. And of course, the result, as you know, was not only did we lose 55,000 fine young men, died, murdered by our own government, in a sense, but we got in a war which was not supported by the people, but was kept alive nevertheless successively by Johnson and then by Nixon, to the point where in riots in Washington, D.C., they had to arrest 20,000 American citizens protesting the war. By those Nazi methods, they managed to make a war nobody wanted last 9 years. But with Kennedy, we would not have had the war because he said most specifically on the 2nd of October, 1963, he told Kenny O'Donnell, and in Kenny O'Donnell's book, Johnny, We Hardly Knew You, we're getting out of Vietnam. We will be completely out by 1965. That means the helicopters and everything. And incidentally, when he said that, we did not have a single combat soldier in Vietnam. As long as Jack Kennedy was alive, we did not have a single combat soldier in Vietnam. And any time you hear anybody say that John Kennedy, like Lyndon Johnson, had something to do with our getting involved in the war in Vietnam, you are listening to a man who doesn't know what he's talking about. The first order he gave in that regard was to return 1,000 of our troops as a gesture that could not be misunderstood, 1,000 troops, by the end of December 1963. But that was countermanded within 24 hours of his death, which gives you some idea of how much backing he had from his own government.
Let's look at his Cuba policy. Bay of Pigs would certainly seem like it was an anti-communist move.
The Bay of Pigs was not his policy. The Bay of Pigs was inherited from the previous administration. And the main designer and supervisor of the Bay of Pigs was a man named Richard Nixon, who later, when he got back in office, helped to keep the Vietnam War going. He was one of the Cold Warriors, a dedicated Cold Warrior from the first time he entered public office. But that was not Kennedy's policy. Kennedy inherited that, and his position, and left no doubt about it, was, I don't have much alternative. People think that I'm failing to follow up on the previous president if I don't go ahead with something that he's initiated, but he was not very enthusiastic about it. He was most reluctant, and the invasion of the Bay of Pigs of Cuba, as you know, was being accomplished by anti-Castro Cubans, trained and backed, of course, by American advisors, by the CIA project. But it was insufficiently backed, and this agency thought that it could jam Jack Kennedy into bringing in the Navy fighter planes, which were just over the horizon on the Navy flat tops. Their engines were even warmed up, so they were obviously intended to be used. But Kennedy didn't intend to bring us into World War III that casually. And so when the man in charge of the Bay of Pigs, General Cabell, Charles Cabell, who just by strange coincidence happened to be the brother of Mayor Earl Cabell, in whose town Jack Kennedy was murdered a year or two later, when General Charles Cabell called on President Kennedy to make the Navy planes available, John Kennedy said, absolutely not, and turned them down. So that was not really John Kennedy's project at all. In the Cuban Missile Crisis, when that was laid on John Kennedy, he recognized it for the crisis it was, for the possible beginning of World War III, but it's important to see that in its perspective. It's becoming increasingly apparent, I think, to most thinking Americans, and I certainly have no grief for the Russians, because I happen to be on the American side and served most of my adult life in the service. But it's becoming increasingly apparent to most Americans that the reason the Russians put the missiles in there was they wanted to discourage any further American adventurism or landing in Cuba. And in any case, whichever view you take, the crisis was laid upon us by those missiles. And Kennedy's view, certainly the right view, was we had to get those missiles out of there. But the approach to recommended to him by the military and our intelligence advisors around Kennedy was to bomb and invade Cuba. A desire much desired, of course, by the military intelligence. But Kennedy replied, as only Kennedy could, wouldn't that kill an awful lot of Cubans? And so he found a solution that they didn't dream of, because you can't deny his intelligence nor his imagination. And his solution, which he was able to work out, communicated through the Russian ambassador and with Khrushchev of Russia, they worked out a solution in which Kennedy's solution was the blockade. Without firing shots, without bombing Cuba, without killing Cuba, we simply set up a blockade. And at first, reluctantly, and then finally, realizing that was the best solution, the Russians ended up pulling out their missiles. And that was what I think can fairly be described as a resolution of the Cuban crisis without drawing the United States into a war. At the same time, it was not a Cold War move. It was an anti-Cold War move, because it used reason rather than force to resolve the problem. Guy Bannister, former special agent in charge of the Chicago office, by 1962 or 63 was working for the Central Intelligence Agency, and his right-hand man was David Ferry, who comes into the story later. But Guy Bannister was operating this anti-Castro movement, which was completely in opposition to everything that Kennedy was talking about and had in mind. It contemplated nothing less, ultimately, than another invasion of Cuba. The Cubans themselves had come, and the anti-Castro adventurers with them, had come to hate John Kennedy for what they regarded as a failure to back them up. But it was quite different. It was a case of avoiding a war on his part when he agreed with Khrushchev not to invade Cuba again. But they never forgave him for that, and nevertheless, even worse, they were continuing to violate the president's specific order, the law of the land, and they were training daily for the ultimate invasion of Cuba. They had a cover name, which they kept secret, but it's kind of surfaced in so many recent years. It's called Operation Mongoose. And it looked like, on the surface, like a legitimate a series of forays against Cuba, ostensibly in the national interest. But if you look at the actual description in the 1961 memorandum of Operation Mongoose, as described by Major General Lansdale, who'd spent years in Vietnam, keeping the Vietnam War going, you will see that it was clear that he had in mind once more the ultimate invasion of Cuba and nothing less. And so what you had under the cover of Operation Mongoose, you had this daily training going north of Lake Pontchartrain. That's how New Orleans comes into it. I didn't put New Orleans into it. Sometimes people say, why you, as if I brought New Orleans into it? And the answer, of course, if I was D.A. of Pittsburgh, it wouldn't have been me. But I'm a D.A. of New Orleans, and New Orleans is where they were setting up this next invasion of Cuba. And every day or so, a day ferry would drive from dressed in army combat outfits, black boots, and he'd drive from Bannister's office across the lake and check the training, which consisted largely of shooting, come back and give his report, and it was moving forward pretty steadily until Kennedy learned in late 63, precisely August 1st, 1963, he learned now that for several years now, his orders against any more anti-Cuba activity, much less preparation for a new land invasion of Cuba, was being violated. So he had to call on the FBI to actually raid the CIA camp where the Cubans and other anti-Castro people were being trained. But even then, the FBI, because the intelligence community protects different parts of each other, did not make it public to the people until we were able to find it out. The troops were being trained there, too, to land in Cuba. But they broke it up for the time being. I'm not sure that made a lot of difference by then. A lot of men had been trained, since this was August 1st, 63, an awful lot of men had been trained and were available to do some shooting when November came in Dallas.
This reminds me a little of some of the Iran-Contra activities that certain elements of intelligence through NSC seemed to be carrying on, a foreign policy that was separate, at least from the espoused policy of the executive branch and certainly the foreign policy of the Congress. But in this case, the president acted through the FBI to break up this secret team's activities.
It's not just a little, that's a very good analogy, a metaphor, but it's not just a little, like, it really is the predecessor to it. In other words, the CIA was, in the Kennedy thing, was not using just CIA individuals, it was going off the shelf, which is his phrase, going outside of the agency offices and so forth, and going to taking some civilian groups and other groups off the shelf operation that was building up by 63, which I just described, the force from which you had the central ingredients that actually murdered John Kennedy, which again leaves it nothing but a CIA murder of John Kennedy, but the covert elements of the CIA, that's what I want to emphasize. But that was indeed the predecessor of the Iran-Contra business. It was the grandfather of that and the others which followed that. I think Casey had in mind setting up a series of off-the-shelf operations, and it probably wasn't the first one the North was involved in.